The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The Buddha would speak to a crowd of 2,500 people. They said nothing about having a speaker system. there's a ancient description or definition or of the Dharma. Dharma is sometimes taken to be the teachings of the Buddha, but the word Dharma also implies something about the basic truths of reality that we connect to through this practice, lives in us, enlightens us. And it's a very powerful word, this word Dharma in Buddhism. And there's a kind of description, definition, or set of characteristics that's used in the liturgy. So like monks and nuns will chant almost every day. They'll chant as part of their regular life. And they'll chant this particular line that describes the Dharma. And I'm quite fond of it. It's a kind of points to some wonderful things. And it goes like this. The Dharma that's proclaimed by the Buddha is visible here and now, immediate, inviting to be seen by oneself, onward leading to be personally realized by the wise. So these five characteristics of it. It is visible here and now. It's immediate. It's inviting to be seen for oneself. It's onward leading. And it's to be realized by the wise. And I think the little bit of a, you know, it's a little bit of a public relations advertisement or something. If you understand that to be realized by the wise is supposed to be kind of you. Yeah, you know, if you're thinking you're supposed to be, you know, if you'd like to be wise, this is what it takes to be realized for oneself. So it is for oneself. It's not something you're supposed to read in a book. It's not supposed to something you're supposed to learn as some external knowledge, but something that we understand for ourselves. And this idea that it's directly visible, it can be seen here and now. So it's not something that you have to read in a book or something you have to take on faith or believe. But there's something in this Dharma that you can really see for yourself. It's like immediate, and it's immediate. It doesn't, apparently it means it doesn't necessarily take a lot of time, or it doesn't involve time. There's something to be realized in the immediacy of this moment here. So it's not so much that the way we get to the Dharma, the full Dharma, is immediate. It takes a while. But whatever it is, it could be experienced immediately here. It can be seen right, it's available. It's not something that is outside of this moment here. And then this wonderful expression to be, inviting to be seen for oneself. There's a beautiful teaching from Chinese Buddhism. Chinese received a tremendous amount of Indian Buddhist texts over many centuries. Huge, huge, tremendous corpus of Indian work. And they kind of received it much faster than it was composed, so they got this huge amount to digest and try to understand. And there were some wonderful Chinese Buddhist monks, scholar monks, who did a tremendous amount of study and delved into it. And one of them, somewhere in the 7th century, wrote this big book, you know, that kind of explains it all based on all his studies. And in that book, he has one line where he says, it can all be summarized like this, that liberation beckons us within everything. Liberation invites us within everything. What a summary. So everything means like anything you encounter, saying, hey, you, become free, wake up. So it's a nice idea, kind of inviting to be seen. Come here and take a good look. What is it that we can see that's liberating? And then onward leading. There's something about the contact with the Dharma, contact with the practice, that once you kind of get a sense of what practice is, what mindfulness is, what to beginning to wake up is, it kind of like it opens, you know, it turns on the conveyor belt, and it'll carry you along. It's onward leading. It kind of points onward. It shows us the way. It's like creates, gives us the compass in which we can find our way forward into a fuller encounter of the Dharma. So I wanted to talk about this. Particularly, I want this idea of onward leading. Onward leading in what way? The Buddha talked about what he said, that he taught a gradual path of practice. And that I see this gradual path that he taught was in fact a journey into oneself, deep inside in a sense. And when you go deep inside, at some point we get turned inside out. And we find out that having gone in, we're out. We're in the world in a whole different way. So rather than thinking that you're going to disappear from the world, it's kind of like you turn yourself inside out. And this, and inside out means that all the sensitivity, all the way that we can be sensitive perhaps, for the world is turned on. It's kind of like all the armor has been turned off and turned inside out, and our sense organs are now operating fully. And so the way that Buddha taught this gradual path of practice, he taught it in many different ways, but one of the highlights is that he did teach a path, something that develops. And it develops kind of in the same way, I think, that human beings mature developmentally from childhood into adulthood. And then once you're an adult, you turn 21, you don't stop maturing. But there's a continual process of development, maturation that goes on. And so this gradual kind of deepening into oneself, maturing. And one of the ways that this path is described is one starts with getting one's conduct in place. And so the kind of the coarsest activity that human beings do, or the grossest, not in the terrible sense of the term, but you know, the biggest things that we do is we walk around and we use our bodies. We speak to each other. We behave physically. And that's visible by everyone, you know, pretty much. And so the first task is to get this into harmony with being compassionate or being not causing harm. And if we can live physically in the world the way we behave without causing harm, if we can speak without causing harm, that is a doorway to begin looking more deeply into oneself, because we're not distracted, we're not preoccupied, we're not externally focused so much, and so that gives you it settles people down. And then you take a step in, closer in. And what's closer in is how we relate to the world. So through our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our body, through our senses. So that's the interface between you and the world, is your senses. And so you want to start being curious and interested about an interface. How do you relate to the world? When you see a bulletin board on the freeway, on Highway 101 here, and it's for the latest electronic gadget, and you see it, the next thing, you don't know how it happens, but the next thing you know, you're at Best Buy. Then, you know, you've been hooked. And if you didn't know how you got to Best Buy, and you didn't even know how this all happened, it means that you were really hooked. You were pulled into this, the world of the senses pulled you in. You saw something, and you didn't even, weren't tracking even what was going on for yourself, and you got pulled into those worlds of senses, and off you went. And this happens often in our lives. We see something, we hear something, someone says something, our ears hear it, and then we get maybe alarmed or upset or angry, or something happens within us. And we get hooked by it and caught by it. Before we know it, we're saying things we wish we hadn't said. So part of that, once we get our behavior in place, the Buddha said, now begin paying attention to your senses. And notice how you're interacting with the world. Can you just be a present through all your senses open without it without getting hooked into things? Just be aware of sounds as sounds, be aware of sights as sights, but don't lose your inner composure, your inner calm, your inner freedom. Don't get hooked in. And so one of the language the Buddha uses, a little different translation than usual, the practice is to safeguard oneself at the sense doors. Protect yourself a little bit there, partly by being more awake, more present in the moment, so that you're there to notice when you see something, notice when you hear something, so that you can kind of just let it be, leave it alone. Don't pick it up. Don't get hooked in. Don't get, end up at Best Buy. And then he taught that the practice of contentment. So I think it's a beautiful practice to be content, if you're content in the right way. But the classic model of contentment is the Buddhist monastic, who's content with the robes that they have, the food that they're given, the bowl they have for eating their food, and the shelter they happen to have at that moment. And they don't possess almost anything else. Very few possessions. They're not supposed to keep any food overnight. And the idea in Buddhist monasticism is that it's not supposed to be asceticism, and it's not supposed to be indulging in the senses or indulging in luxury, but it's supposed to be the middle way between asceticism and indulging in the senses, they say. And that middle way is to have just enough for us to be healthy and well, but not anymore. And then to be content with that, to have a sense of contentment. And there's a nun, Buddhist nun, who lives in Mountain Views. She's taught here a few times, Santusika. And her name means contentment. And she probably is, for herself. She's also a little bit of a environmental activist, so she has some kind of healthy discontent too. But to have at least some kind of ability to be content with your life, and exactly where the boundaries are between discontent and content is something to be negotiated and figured out. In Buddhism, we're not supposed to be only content. The contentment, we're supposed to be discontented with our suffering. Because if you're content with your suffering, you don't do anything about it. So so the idea of being content with, what you have, maybe. So you're not always looking for more and better. You're not always trying to improve when no improvement is really needed for your basic well-being. So these movements of caring for our ethical conduct, waking up and being present for our senses, so we're not caught in the world, we're present for the world, not caught in it, to have a modicum of contentment, then is a foundation for doing meditation practice. And then, so that's now coming in more deeply. So the physical activities is how we are in the world, interact with the world. Through the senses is another way we interact with the world. And contentment is another way in which we interact with the world, by being content with what we have. And this having these things kind of settled enough, then when we sit down to meditate, we're less inclined to be outwardly focused, thinking about sitting in meditation here at IMC, thinking how far away is Best Buy? And you know, that's what you spend your 45 minutes thinking about because you saw the bulletin board and it's, you know, really exciting. But, you know, you're content with what you have. You're content, you're not pulled into the world of electronics. And so you sit down and you more able to sit here and be present and, in a sense, turn inward to become aware of what's going on inside. And then to begin noticing the swirls and the agitation and the movements of the mind in a much more acute way than we normally can in everyday life. And start noticing what the mind is chasing after. The mind, our thoughts, are often chasing after different concerns and interests. And the two kind of movements of concern that are quite popular is desire of all kinds and ill will, hostility and anger. And to start realizing how the mind operates so much for and against things. And then learn to settle that. Learn not to be caught in that, the bulletin boards in the mind. And then also not be caught in resistance and to what's going on. Not being caught in restlessness to what's going on. And not being caught in whatever, in the world of doubt and uncertainty, which can be quite a strong pull, the big bulletin board of billboard of doubt. And so we're starting to kind of track and notice what's going on in our minds, so that we're not, again, hooked in so strongly. And the advantage of being able to settle these things is that the mind gets to be quieter and quieter, more peaceful. And this movement towards a peaceful mind that's not caught in things is where we start seeing the Dharma that's visible here and now. And that is, the way the Buddha talked about this and how he defined visible here and now is to see that a mind that was caught up in stuff, caught up in anger, caught up in desire, caught up in envy, conceit, caught up in, he goes through a whole bunch of things, jealousy, all kinds of emotions. See how the mind was caught in those things and see when the mind is no longer caught. That simple movement. Wow, I was so preoccupied about going shopping. I sat here for 30 minutes at IMC meditating. For 30 minutes, I was caught up in something. But then finally, I settled and relaxed. And then for the last 15 minutes, all those preoccupations seems to drain away. And I was no longer thinking about Best Buy. That was good. I was no longer caught up in my anger and animosity I had, or the jealousy, or the anxiety, or the greed, or whatever we were caught by. And then to have a palpable feeling, a visceral feeling of release, of relief, of peace, of openness, of clarity, some kind of feeling of goodness, some kind of feeling of freedom, that we're no longer caught, and how good that this is. To be able to see that difference in whatever degree we can see it, is considered a way of seeing the Dharma. The Dharma makes itself visible here and now. So this is not something you learn from a book, unless the book is your own heart. You study yourself, and you start seeing how these works, how your mind is operating, and learning to see that the mind has an ability to be caught up, preoccupied, attached, and it has the ability, has the potential of becoming peaceful, at ease, settled, clear, open, transparent, settled, stable. That seeing that for oneself is seeing the Dharma visible here and now. And if you see that freedom that could come, something where you were not free, you see that it's immediate right now. Wow, I'm free here. in this to this degree, I'm free now. And so in some way, I don't know exactly, I can't really tell you how this works, I'm just inspired by it. It's inviting us to come and see for ourselves. So certainly you can say it, you know, just, you know, and then Buddha teaches the Dharma, he's saying, please, try it out for yourself and find out for yourself. And that's pretty, you know, straightforward. But I get this sense that there's kind of a deep request. There's a deep kind of heartfelt wish when we encounter the world, when we meet the world, to not be caught by it. And there's an invitation in that meeting of the world, wherever we are, to find out how can we be there and be free in the midst of it. And I kind of sense that there's a yearning, a desire. If you tune in, if you're kind of get quiet and listen, I think there's a kind of natural movement towards wanting to be free. So this, and then freedom beckons us within everything. And then onward leading. So if you get a sense of the, what it's like to go from being caught in the mind to the mind no longer caught, from being agitated to becoming calm, from being on fire with greed, hate, and delusion to being cool with peace, and you start valuing the goodness that can come from that, that becomes a personal compass for what we're moving into, what the guide is. And so the movement in the Dharma is towards letting go of preoccupation into this place of peace. It's not about memorizing endless lists of Dharma principles. It's not about magic mantras that you chant so that somehow the mantras are going to do something for you. Or it's not about getting Buddhist crystals that somehow you drape around your neck and somehow they'll absorb cosmic energies and somehow enlighten you or free you. But it's this compass to see in my own mind how I relate to things, how I meet things, how I show up for things, how I free myself of things. That's where the Dharma is found. That's where freedom is found. And so it becomes a compass. And so generally people who get into this practice, at some point they have an experience or a sense or intuition or a feeling, knowledge, of what it's like for the mind to be at peace. What it's like for the mind to be free. What's it like? Different people describe it different ways for themselves. And it becomes a feeling, for me it was a feeling of deep integrity. That was the hook that got me into this. And that became my guide for a long time, this feeling of integrity. Other times for me it's been a feeling of deep peace. Sometimes it's been a feeling of ease. The mind at ease. Sometimes it's a feeling of the mind being boundless, just being open and expansive, sense of expansiveness and spaciousness. Sometimes an experience of compassion and love that comes along with it. And so this becomes like a reference point. And then the question is, how do I expand these things? How do I fill my life? How do I do this more fully? How do I find the edges of where I can't do this and practice with that and explore it, and so that there too I can find this peace. Not to turn away from things, but to expand our freedom into them, maybe so we can encompass those things also. And so it's our own, the quality of our own mind or our own heart and its potential that becomes the onward leading compass to do it more and more and more. And then this is to be realized by the wise. This is something only you can do for yourself. No one can do it for you. No one can, there's all kinds of things. No one can sleep for you. No one can pee for you. There's all kinds, I can go on, right? There's all kinds of things that only you can do. Only you can realize the Dharma. Only you can realize this freedom of the mind. Only you can do this inner work that is quite profound. So, so in this way, the Dharma is visible here now. It's something that's available to you to see and experience for yourself. And the chances are fairly good, I think, that some point in your lives that you've had some experience that has shown you a potential you have for being in the world that's not neurotic, that's not filled with anxiety, that's not caught up in greed or lust, that's not filled with jealousy or anger or hostility or hatred, but somehow something has settled or quieted or felt safe. Sometimes some people have it as children. For me, I had a number of experiences as a child that became a reference point for me when I started meditating. And it's kind of, I think I kind of remembered them when I started meditating, like kind of, you know, forgotten memories. And one of them was being under the dining room table. I would get a white sheet, like a bed sheet, and drape it over the table, and made, I think I called it a fort. And I probably hardly knew what a fort was. But and then I would go underneath, and this, and the lighting, and it was so peaceful in there, and the lighting coming in to the kitchen and, you know, through this under the sheet, I don't know what to say, but I still remember it, a kind of clean light or something, peaceful light. And I felt so content and peaceful and cozy. I would just sit there. And so I started meditating. Oh, I remembered that. Oh. And there were other things like that. And some things happened to me when I was, you know, kind of just out of the blue. when I was 19, I went to, traveled around Europe. And I went to a Catholic monastery, cathedral, church, all of the above, I don't know. It's called Mont Saint-Michel. And it's, if you come across it, if you're driving across this parts of Brittany and Normandy, and it suddenly it looms up ahead of you like it's some kind of place, something made by Disneyland. And this huge kind of, you know, spiring up kind of thing. It's on a hill and it goes higher up, pointing towards heaven. And it's a kind of big place. But I got a tour of the place. And on top of the hill, where everything is built around, was original chapel that had been built 1,000 years ago or something. And everything else was built around that chapel, a little stone chapel. And when they took us into the chapel, there was something so peaceful and cool and settled there that my inside just went completely kind of just dissolved and felt so soft and tender and quiet and so peaceful. And I tried to linger in that room as long as I could before the tour guide said, you have to go now. So maybe I was lucky to have those experiences. But, you know, those things. So sometimes you don't have to do a lot of meditation to have this, but to remember sometimes, oh, this is a potential. This is a possibility. This is the Dharma that's visible here and now. Now, how can I move into that? How can I fill that in my life? How can I expand it? How can I rediscover it? What's the work that it takes? To answer that question, the Buddha offers a gradual path. That in his approach, you would start, to repeat myself, start with the larger ways in which we live in the world, our actions and our speech. And then we look at the interface between us and the world, how we see it, our senses, and kind of clarify that relationship and so we don't get caught so easily. And then we would look in and figure out how to live in a healthy way, which is to give contentment with what we have in our life as it is, not for its own sake, but so that we have this inner capacity to look more deeply inside of ourselves, because we're not preoccupied and caught by the all kinds of things in the world, And then to start start becoming really wise, seeing clearly for a few of us, not all of you, of course, but for a few of us, the craziness in there. You know, all the, you know, someone once said that the mind has no shame. I don't know if that's a good thing to say, you know, it certainly a little bit too interesting sometimes what this mind can do. So, you know, to start becoming wise and see actually what the mind thinks about, what its preoccupations are, what its reactivity is, to really start getting to see it more and more clearly so we can discover how to settle the mind. How we can help the mind feel safer and more contented, more peaceful, so it's not anxious anymore, so it's not always searching outside of itself for things, so it's not always resisting and attacking and blaming, but learning to kind of become freer and freer and freer. And that movement towards freedom can grow and grow and grow. And it's one of the most beautiful things profound things a person can do with their lives. And to do that process well, then at some point we get turned inside out, and then we're back in the world with a sensitivity of compassion and love and care. We're back in the world in a very different way than when we started this path and this process. And my hope is that this process will somehow grow us into being people who live for the welfare of others, that we live in a concern for the welfare of the world and in whatever way is appropriate for each individual. And so this whole path of practice leads us to becoming people who care and are and active in for the betterment of our society. So the Dharma proclaimed by the Buddha is visible here and now. It's immediate, inviting to be seen for oneself, onward leading to be realized by the wise. So if you're aspiring to be wise or wise enough, we have some time and you can ask some questions about this. Anything you'd like to comment or anything you'd like to say? So it should be green. Green light.
Since many of us have careers, right? And we're involved in careers that we hopefully think are contributory to the welfare of humanity, or, you know, some of us get very lucky to be able to do that. And, you know, you get involved and you do get hooked on the success of a project, or you get hooked on, you know, I was thinking of you, actually, you know, I can't imagine that you didn't get hooked on making IMC, you know, more contributory to the human beings in this area. And, of course, that's, it seems to me you've done that, but you've been surrounded by people who are, that of course you've been the teacher for, and most of us are in the ordinary environment of people who are in doing the work that you may be doing that have other interests, maybe just monetary or what have you, you know. And it's, I'm sort of making a comment and then giving it back to you, but, you know, there's a lot to be said that it's not just finding peace, but also finding a way to still be active in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that was the other possible topic for a Dharma talk today. Was I was thinking about giving it, talking about what's called right livelihood, because a lot of people are working, and the whole idea of it's a big part of people's lives, and so to talk about practicing in the context of livelihood. But what I talked about just seemed easier to talk about, given how complex the work life can be in livelihood, and I felt like I needed to be better prepared than I could be today for that topic. So I appreciate your comment then. And so here is many things to be said, maybe in response or to what you said, but one of the things I think it's very helpful to remember that there are two ways, two general categories of ways in which we can be of help to the world. One is based on what we do, and the other is how we are. And I think that in this kind of society we have here in California, here in this area here particularly, I think there's sometimes an over concern for the what. Having the right career, or you know, doing the thing that's our thing, or the thing that's going to, you know, create world peace. Do something. So people are very concerned about the what. The career. and that's fine, and some people find a what that's really meaningful for them. But there are some people who find themselves fulfilled and find that what's right for them and what has the most meaning is not the what they do, but how they are with whatever they're doing. And they find a way, the how is they're ethical, the how is they're kind, the how is that they are practicing with all this. Finding the path, finding their freedom, finding their goodness, and how they are doing it becomes the real task. So, you know, if you have a career and you're engaged, and it's a good career and good work, please keep it up. But maybe you can make it your monastery, meaning that maybe that's the place where you study yourself, where you find yourself, where you kind of look and go deeper and deeper to figure out how you can do it in a way that the how you do is as much a message as what you do.
Thank you.
You mentioned your memory of when you were younger under the table. If you're having those kind of memories, are you not being pulled away from the present moment?
Well, you know, this present moment thing is a little bit overrated in our society. it's kind of like the name of the game. What we're trying to do is develop a greater capacity to be present, for sure. And but sometimes I, sometimes people think that they're all they're allowed to do is be present, and anything that departs from it is somehow wrong. You know, a rich, multifaceted life includes our past and our memories, includes the future and what's going to come, and thinking about it to some degree. So we're not trying to erase the past or be unconcerned for the future. But what we want to do is, to the degree to which we are thinking about the past and the future, to do it wisely and to do it so we're not caught by it. And so one of the reasons we practice being in the present moment is to help us learn what it's like not to be caught. Once we really learn how to do that, and then we've kind of lessened some of the forces of attachment within us, then it's possible to think about the past and think about the future and it not be a problem. There's no attachment to it and we're not caught by it. But the other thing that happens is that when people, it's quite a profound process to do regular meditation and really go in deep inside. Sometimes what happens as we touch in more and more deeply in ourselves, it's kind of like we're touching into places, stored memories. We're touching into unresolved issues. We're touching into things that were quite important and formative to us. And they arise in our memory, unbidden. And that arising into memory, unbidden, sometimes is actually an important part of the process. For some things, it's part of the a cleansing process, purification process. It needs to come up to consciousness in order to be resolved and worked through. And it's also some of the freeing process. It's kind of we remember some of the beautiful potential, beautiful capacities we have. So these good memories, and repressed memories are not only bad. There's also good ones. Like, maybe not repressed, but there's things that we forget. And sometimes reclaiming them and having them return is part of the process of reconnecting to these aspects of ourselves maybe we have lost touch with. So don't worry so much about these memories. Just don't be caught by them. So in meditation, what I'd like to do is, if memories arise unbidden, I just kind of take it as an important part of the process. I don't know how it's important, but I just kind of assume it's there, important. And then I go back to the breathing. I don't try to linger with it. I don't try to think about it. I don't try to analyze it. I don't feel bad about it. I just feel content. Oh, okay. It probably needed to arise. And now let's go back and stay in the present moment with the breathing. And that way there's space for these kinds of things to arise. And if it's part of some deeper, something's working itself out in us, there's space for that. Does that make sense? Are you content with that answer? Or did you have something else in mind?
No.
Okay. We probably have time for one more if you have a question or comment. Well, I hope that this kind of dharma that the Buddha was pointing to, which is not really something that's foreign or mysterious, it's something that's in yourself, that it can be a nice path for you to move towards greater peace and freedom and greater contributions to this world. May the dharma live in you. Thank you.